You know, the FBI says 85% of the serial killers have been coming from the United States. 85%. And 20 to 50 active serial killers are out there right now in this country. Hard to believe. Good grief. We'll be back in a moment. We'll take your phone calls and your stories on parapsychology with Stacy Horn, author of the book Unbelievable, next on Coast to Coast AM. Stacy, what's your next work and research?
I have not decided. There's a couple of ideas I'm kicking around, and actually after talking to you, I was thinking it would be interesting to put together a compilation of these letters. They're just fascinating to read. But I would like to do something in science. I really enjoyed researching the scientific process, like how they went about coming up with experiments and refining them. It's very interesting to me.
Tell me about your work with NPR.
I don't, I just do things time to time when just something really gets me. And I'm actually working on a piece right now that came out of this book. It's a piece about audio forensics. I was listening to those EVP tapes.
Mm-hmm. That's scary.
Yes. And I, as a result, I learned about this whole field of audio forensics, these guys who, you know, listen to recorded sounds and try to determine what they are, like what the voices are saying, but what the other sounds are. It's just amazing. So I'm working on a piece about that.
Why don't you do something on people's phobia of clowns? I hate clowns. But, you know, I don't run around, you know, screaming and hiding from them, but I just don't like them.
I don't either. A lot of people don't. I don't think children do. I think they go and they can tell that they're expected to like them, and so they go along with it. But I think they're like us, and they don't like them either.
You know, I what I think it is for me, it's who's behind the costume? You know, what is this person? Who's this individual?
Right.
And, you know, then you think of Stephen King's It. Right?
Oh, God, yeah.
Those fang teeth.
Yeah.
Let's go to the phones. You ready?
Yes. Can't wait.
Go to Claire, Michigan. Ken on the wild card line. Hey, Ken, go ahead.
Hey, how you doing, George?
Good, Ken.
Glad to hear from you.
Thanks.
And Stacy as well. I had a statement here real quick, and then I had a quick question afterwards.
Okay.
When I was younger, I was born and raised old Catholic, so I had old certain beliefs that came along with it, and I was told that not to believe, you know, that you saw this and you saw that, even though the experiences kept happening throughout my age. I was able to feel things and I was able to see things. And I'm an artist, so I do a lot of automated drawings. I do a lot of art, so on and so forth, and in acrylics and whatnot. That was just a little bit of background. It's more deeper than that, and I can get into a lot more. But my question that I have at hand is that I had a traumatic brain injury and bipolar to top it off, okay? And there was a lot that has occurred through the whole incident. And I was wondering in parapsychology what type of studies was being done on that in general. Do you know anything about that?
Well, we know Peter Hurkos, for example, as I mentioned, fell off a ladder and claims that he got all his abilities that way. Did you come across anything like that, Stacy?
I did. Ryan didn't study this, but there's a neuroscientist named Persinger, Dr. Michael Persinger in Canada, who is doing research in this area. And I did talk to him, and he was saying that they did, not surprisingly, find a correlation between brain injury and having experiences like that. Now, I know some people would write that off and say the brain injury was causing visual and audio hallucinations, but he seemed to indicate that there was also indications that that was not the case, that there was some sort of, like, there was more intent and more consciousness behind the experiences that people were having.
What's been going on with you, Ken?
Well, basically it started out because I never really got any help. I had a fractured cranium, massive hematoma to the front temporal lobe, so there was blood left in my head. And so that meant that the neurons wasn't communicating with one side or the other, okay? And what had happened past that, I was a very slow learner, and then they declared me bipolar after, so on and so forth. But what really started happening is that I was able to pick up things and feel things. I was able to draw things, and people recognized things. Or I was able to look at an individual and pick up like an image from. And I was following the whole show that you're doing here, so I'm very familiar. As a matter of fact, you know, all the way back into the 70s, I played the Ouija board, and I was one number off from 1.5 mil. And because I turned my head and said, I'll never win, I marked down the wrong number. There you go there. You know, I mean, you know, that's a good and bad coincidence.
Right.
Following, you know, but the most, probably the most thing that really bothers me is that I was told never to share these abilities. And I've always had my opinion. When I feel things or see things, I speak. I don't keep it. It's like, you know, normally when you keep something in your brain, I speak it. And I just speak what I see correct, straightforward out. And a lot of the times I'm correct, and I usually get looked upon as weird. Or, you know, like something that they want to push back off, you know, inside the wall.
Right.
And the way that I explained it, you know, you go into a psychiatrist and you say, hey, you know, if you're in church and you say you hear God, boy, everybody's all for that, you know, because I'm able to sit down there and communicate with God. But if you sit down here and say that you might hear something or tell you to stay away from something.
Then you're nuts, right?
Correct. Yeah. Correct. And the thing about neuropsychology and my experiences through this is that I know through CT scans and what they're able to do through the CT scans and what they're doing as in following waves upon, you know, habitual liars, and, you know, all the rest of that stuff, that they've been able to accumulate, you know, with the knowledge with these CT scans and the further technology that they've been able to do. And when she mentioned the neuropsychologist, I'm very familiar, you know, you would have figured there was got to be at least one individual out of the whole neuropsychology field that has seen enough to become aware that there are capabilities that 99% of the brain that supposedly we don't use, that it is out there, that, you know, it does, that it can appear more quickly with somebody that has a damaged brain and whatnot. And I was just wondering how you felt about it and maybe some direction, you know, possibly, you know, is where to go to get some information on it.
I would definitely contact this guy, Dr. Michael Persinger. He's at, I may be pronouncing this incorrectly, but Laurentian University in Canada. And I just Googled his name and got his email and emailed him, and he answered me. But
spell his name again.
Persinger.
Okay, that'll help you, Ken. If Dr. Ryan were alive today, with today's technology at his disposal, Stacy, what do you think he'd be working on? Same thing?
Yeah, well, the answer to that, again, is Robert John. He did do experiments testing the same abilities, but with more modern equipment, like he used computers, and his results were similar.
Canton, Ohio, Mary, Wildcard Line. Hi, Mary.
Hello, George, and hello, Stacy. George, you ask such great questions. I'm just standing by the radio so tired. But I can't go to sleep, and it's because it's so interesting. Stacy, it's wonderful the way you describe everything. If your book is as good as the way you talk, I'm going to buy it.
Oh, thank you.
Tomorrow. I wanted to ask you, through all of your research, Stacy, if you have gotten your interest piqued to find out if you've got any psychic abilities or could develop any through all of this?
Yes and no. I mean, no, because I'm a chicken. I mean, I scare very easily. But yes, and I'm definitely just very intrigued now.
Yeah.
Like, wherever I go, like, I'm constantly reaching out to scientists saying, you know, look, I found this, it is what it is, you know, could you just unemotionally, objectively, just look at these results and just mull it over? I've written to someone who's been a guest on this show many times, Michio Kaku.
Yes.
And a Stanford physicist named Andre Lind, because I believe the effects are real, we just do not know the explanation, and I'm just amazed at the lack of curiosity. I mean, it's a clue about something in the universe.
It's crazy. It's really wild. I also wanted to tell George that I know you had said that you had an out-of-body experience at the age of 11.
Yes, right, Mary.
I've been working on it for 2 years. I even wrote you one day last week to see if you had any suggestions because I had only gotten my hands and my arms out. Last night, I had one, a full out-of-body. Only lasted about 10 seconds, but I totally out. And I just wanted to share that.
What ended it? Did you just realize you were doing
it? Realized that was it, yeah.
Yep, that's what does it.
Yeah, I sat up once another time and realized it, and it did it. So I don't know how you just turn yourself off from realizing it, but I just wanted to share that with you, and thank you for taking my call.
Okay. We know Robert Monroe did a lot of work with astral projection, Stacy, but do you know if J.B. Rhine did?
No, it was not an area that he was interested in. But weirdly, this came up for me just last week. I do this thing called mindful-based stress reduction.
Yeah.
It's a meditation technique. And the person that has been teaching me was just doing a guided meditation and talked about dissolving the boundaries of the body. And I just started thinking, oh, my God, this is along the lines of everything I've been researching again, like escaping the bounds of the physical body.
Absolutely incredible that Rhine would just key in on one or two areas of parapsychology and he wouldn't branch out.
I know it was frustrating to everyone around him, but researching and from all these years later, he was absolutely right to do so. I mean, it's kind of along the lines of it was a dirty job, someone had to do it. He had to come up with a standardized procedure for tests that could be repeated. It's like ghosts are great, and I would like to know more about them, but it's very hard to pin them down and learn anything from them. So you have to start somewhere. So he was starting with the smallest piece, and yes, that's frustrating, but it's ultimately necessary. I mean, that's how science works. You have to begin somewhere, and you could jump all over the place and research all these things and then never make progress in this one area.
Let's go to Dubuque, Iowa, where Michael is, east of the Rockies. Hey, Michael, go ahead.
Yes, George. I'm going to semi-apologize. I started listening to Coast to Coast on 1500 KSTP on the very first day it was broadcast, and this is the first time I've called.
No need to apologize.
I would like to ask your guest, I guess it's a trifold question, in regards to our semi-domesticated animals and their intuition, cats, dogs, and even like dolphins and pigs will exclude the primates, but their connection to human beings, such as where, you know, they will put a dog, you know, with a cancer patient or a epilepsy mm-hmm. patient, and the animals have this intuitive response. And do you think or believe that the animals that we are with have a closer mental intuition, and if so, how or why? Or it was kind of a sidebar as to all the conversation, but you are just a fantastic guest. And
thank you,
George.
Yes, sir.
You know, like I said, I semi apologize, but this is an awesome show, and I had just a question that I thought maybe she could give me her opinion, which I would appreciate, and maybe, you know, think about it, you know, whatever
okay.
she said.
All right.
Sure.
I'll let you listen on the radio, Michael. Go ahead.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Rhine did some work with animals just because one of the frequent complaints about their experiments was it was all fraud, and so he thought, you know, like the ES machine, working with animals would eliminate the claim of fraud. But the person that actually did has done a lot of work in this area. We mentioned him before, Rupert Sheldrake. He I think his book is something like Animals Know When You're Coming Home. Are you familiar with this book?
Yeah, I'll get the correct title in a second.
And I've listened to him speak on the subject, and he would be the person to go to learn more about it. But me personally, I definitely believe there's a connection between myself and my pets.
They're tuned in. You know, and I think, Stacey, it all comes down to energy, and pets have an ability to sense energy and levels of energy beyond what a human being can be. A simple explanation, of course, is a dog can hear something that a human can't because mm-hmm. of the frequencies. Mm-hmm. But I think animals sense objects. If you're a believer in life after death in the spirit world, I'm convinced that animals can sense spirits as well. They may not see them, yet I've seen a dog look around the room as if they were looking at something and it was not there. At least we couldn't see it.
We've all seen that. My cats do the same thing. Like, they jump up and look at things and there's absolutely nothing there. And it's not like they jump up, look, and then look away. They keep staring at the empty space.
They are so tuned in, and you know, I couldn't say a dog more than a cat or a cat more than a dog, but those animals are pretty darn powerful.
And it, like, there's definitely the emotional connection, and there's nothing paranormal about that.
Here's the name of one of his books.
Okay.
Dogs That Know When Their Owners Are Coming Home and Other Unexplained Powers of Animals. So that's got to be one of his big ones.
Well, and I want to point out that he, like Rhine, developed experiments to test that, if that's true.
Yes.
And established, I think, convincingly that they do.
Well, he was and is one of the best when it comes to that.
Yeah.
Let's take another call before the break. Mark in Redding, California, west of the Rockies. Hey, Mark.
I'm sorry.
You're,
I'm George.
You're Mark. I'm George.
This is Mark McCandlish. I've been a guest on your show a couple
times. Yeah, absolutely.
I've had things like this happening to me since I was a kid, usually in the form of a dream that I have days or a week or so before the actual event. And it always seems as though in the dream I'm seeing the event, whatever it may be, through the eyes of a participant. Not always myself, but sometimes other people. Like, George, you and I have a mutual friend by the name of Sting Smith,
mm-hmm.
Sting Marine, or Jeff. Well, he has several.
Several.
Alias.
Alias.
Because of his work.
Because of his work.
He was in the Marines over in Iraq and stuff for a while, and then he went into kind of a mercenary mode where he was in Africa, but he never actually told me where he was. And I had this dream one night that there had been this terrible accident where there were a group of armed men in the back of a Land Rover with kind of a steel cage and, you know, heavily armed with guns and flak vests and things. And they were after somebody in this little village, and it looked like somewhere in eastern Africa, like Darfur or Somalia or someplace like that. And I heard a voice say, "They're back that way," and the driver whips into a vacant lot off of this dirt road, hits some soft soil. The vehicle overturns, and one person is killed almost instantly when his head is crushed, and another person is pinned under the vehicle with his leg bleeding. You know, and I could see my hands digging at the sand, trying to get a space underneath the truck to put in a scissor jack. And I look up, and I see a guy who's a spitting image of Rob Reiner. And 9 days later, he sends me an email, and he says, "What you talked about in your dream happened 2 days before I got your email."
See, isn't that something? Truly something. We'll be back in a moment with Stacey Horn in just a second. Well, what's going on at the Search for Extraterrestrial Intelligence, SETI? We'll check in tomorrow with Seth Shostak on our next Coast to Coast show, Confessions of an Alien Hunter. Now, when we come back, we'll take your calls, final calls, with Stacey Horn on Coast to Coast AM. Stacey, where do you pick up your book, Unbelievable?
It should be in bookstores starting tomorrow, but you can definitely get it online at Amazon and all the various online booksellers.
We jumped on this one fast, didn't we? Let's go to Staten Island, New York. First-time caller, Mary, thanks for calling. Hi.
Hi, George. Hi, Stacey.
Hi.
Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I wanted to tell you about an incident that happened when my son was about 16. my husband and I went to see an Elvis Presley movie, and I'm a big fan of Elvis. And in the middle of the movie, it seemed like he was talking to me and said, "Get home, your son's in trouble."
Elvis did?
Yeah.
In the movie?
Yeah. And I turned to my husband and I said, "Did you hear that?" And he said, "What?" Mm-hmm. And I said, "We got to get home." And he said, "What are you talking about?" Well, I got him out. We called a cab, jumped in the cab. The cab was going in a different direction. I said, no, I want to go this way. He said, "Lady, that's the longer way around." I said, "I don't care. I want to go this way." He finally went the way I asked him to. He stopped for a red light at some point, and I looked across the road, and I saw somebody lying in the road.
Oh, no.
And the bike was, whoever was on a bike, the bike had been hit and turned over, and this person was laying on the ground. And I said to the cab driver, go over there. Somebody's hurt. I went over there, and it was my son.
Oh, my God. Is he okay?
He's all right now, yeah. This was when he was 16. He's fine now.
Okay.
I was wondering, I've had these experiences before. I had it with my younger son, something similar, and he was fine.
Mm-hmm.
I had it with my daughter, my middle child, and unfortunately she passed away.
Oh.
And I was wondering, if you get these messages, why do you get them if you can't somehow change the outcome? I mean, I think I was helpful in changing the outcome with my two sons, but not with my daughter, and I don't understand why.
That's like a big life question that I'm not sure how to answer, but the Rhymes had a theory about your experiences. I was talking about there's information out there, that we can't explain. And they had a theory that sometimes when you get information like this, you have like a visual hallucination. Like, for instance, you said Elvis was speaking to you at the movie theater. Now, a lot of people would just immediately write that off. She's crazy. She thinks Elvis is speaking to her.
Right.
But what they said instead was, there's information out there that some people have access to and we can't explain. We don't know how it's happening. But what we think is that the mind gets this information and there has to be some way to bring it to your consciousness so that you can actually access it and understand it. So they think that your experience was an hallucination, but that doesn't mean it's not real.
Right.
It was just the vehicle that the mind created to get that very urgent information to your conscious mind so that you could act on it. So you were at the movie theater, you were watching Elvis Presley, so the mind just seized on Elvis Presley as the vehicle to communicate that information to you. So the visual hallucination was not real. The information was, which you acted on it. And why you couldn't act on it in this case with your daughter, which just breaks my heart, I can't really answer that. Your gift sometimes gives you something that you can use, and sometimes it doesn't. It's like, it can't always help with the outcome, and it can't maybe pick and choose which information it's going to give to you. I mean, maybe if there was some intent behind it, it could and said, "I'm only going to filter through information that you can act on," but it can't.
Mm. Okay, thank you so much, Tracy.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Stacy, you show some compassion on these calls, too, and I have to applaud you for that.
Thank you. I was just like, thinking of Ryan, who was often faced with this, wanting to help and give answers and not always having the answers to give people.
Nope, they're not always there, are they?
No.
Graysville, Alabama, we go east of the Rockies. It's Georgie. Hey.
Hi. How you doing? I wanted to ask if she'd ever talked to Dan Aykroyd. I know he's a big paranormal fan, and I heard that he based writing Ghostbusters on the paranormal. The guy doing the work in the colleges of paranormal.
I haven't. I would love to, and I would love to make a movie out of my book.
Good guy. He's a fan of the show. Maybe we can get it to him, huh?
Oh, I would love to be on the show sometime.
Well, you know, I wondered because again, like, it was Ghostbusters that was in my head when I went down to Duke.
Well, I can't wait to read the book. I know it's going to be wonderful.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Do you find, Stacy, that interest in paranormal continues to get bigger and bigger and bigger?
Well, yes, but, when I was reading the letters from the scientists at Duke, they always felt like acceptance was around the corner. And I'm thinking, well, am I also, somehow deluded by what I hope to be true? But it does seem to be the case. I mean, the polls definitely show that the general public is more accepting. But I do seem to sense that about science as well. Like, for instance, in Michio Kaku's book, he does say that the laws, telepathy and psychokinesis, do not conflict with the laws of science as we know today. Now, I think how he imagines telepathy and psychokinesis is different than Rhine. But at least it shows an open mind, and other scientists that I've talked to, they put it in the context of what they know, but they're not as hostile.
Well, that's true. Next up, Huntsville, Alabama, we go. Michael, take it away. Hi, Mike.
How you doing? Good talking with you all tonight.
Thank you.
I've got kind of an off-the-wall question, and I want to give an example if possible. My question, we have a lot of Indian burial grounds down here, Creek, Cherokee, and something I've noticed, I've seen ever since I was a little kid, at different times I'd see, ghosts, apparitions kind of things around these different burial grounds. Now, my question is, do you think that, for instance, in the political arena, as we get more contentious, as society is contentious with each other, and I'll give an example after this, what I'm talking about, that it brings paranormal or spiritual activity, makes it more visible, or what I'm getting at is the hospital, for instance. I was listening to, am I allowed to say other talk show hosts?
Of course.
Okay. I was listening to Rush Limbaugh, which I listened to quite a bit. And today, just right out of the blue, he called Charles Barkley a milk dud head. Now, if there's not anything more contentious, I don't know what it is. Now, that's what I'm using as an example. The political arena is so contentious and evil. And do you think that has any effect because these people are nationwide? They affect the national psyche. Do you think that has any effect on bringing to the forefront psychic or supernatural or ghostly activity?
There are some parapsychologists. I think Robert John is also in this group, Bill Roll and William Joynes, who talk about objects or areas that are more emotionally charged. Do seem to, like if you're looking at examples of psychokinesis, the reason why it happens in the homes with objects close by because they are more emotionally charged than objects that are further away. But it's not something I do know a lot about, but if you were interested in exploring it, those would be the names of the people I would read.
We ran into Jennifer Love Hewitt this weekend of Ghost Whisperer, and I noticed you mention it in your book.
Yeah, yeah. That Ghost Whisperer, that whole idea is like another universe away from what J.B. Rhine was doing. Not a comment on it, it's just very different.
It's Hollywood.
Yeah.
That's the difference.
Well, it's Hollywood, but based on, I believe, the people behind that show, this is something that they believe in.
Well, Marianne Winkowski, who's one of the consultants on the show, is a true believer and communicator. And let's go to Brainerd, Minnesota. Mike, Wildcard Line. Hey, Michael.
Oh, George, Stacy.
Hi.
Great show tonight.
Take it away.
Hey, I just wanted to throw a theory out that I have and get your opinion. It's about the predicting of the roll of the dice or the coin flip more times than it's supposed to happen.
Okay.
Okay.
My theory is that you're not actually predicting it, but and making it happen. Are you familiar with the game of cribbage? In cribbage, the deck gets cut every hand, and the card that turns up can be used in combination with your cards at the end of play for points. When I'm concentrating on it, I know that the card that I want to cut to come up gets cut and comes up way more often than if I'm not paying attention or just kind of playing along, you know?
Well, with the dice, that is exactly what they believed was happening, that the person was influencing the roll of the dice. With the cards, since the cards were already dealt, they would have to...
Right, but there was the cut. It's when the deck is cut, and
uh-huh.
I'm concentrating on the card that I need for my hand to be a good hand, you know, and it seems like it comes up way more often when I'm concentrating on it.
Well, I would believe the Rhines would agree with you. The only difference would be that they would say you can't influence that a lot. Like, you wouldn't be able to do that very often.
Well, no, definitely not. But, I mean, it is way more often that it happens than if I'm just, you know, like I say, not playing or not concentrating and just...
Right. And that always frustrated them because the person's intent was definitely an influence, but they just couldn't figure out how that worked.
Right. All right, thank you.
Okay,
thank
you.
You
got it. Next up, whose turn? It's Annapolis, Maryland. We go with you, John. Hey, John.
Hey, George, how you doing?
Good.
I just caught the end of the show. I just turned my radio on, and I heard a guy call in about animals that know when their owners are coming home.
Yes.
And my mother has had pet crows for, like, the last 35 years. And when we were growing up, you know, the crows were in cages, but they would know about 8 to 10 minutes before she would come home, that she was coming home. They'd go nuts.
They'd squawk and everything, huh?
They'd go crazy, and we'd be out in the in the swimming pool.
You know
and
it.
And the pool house was where the crow cages were. And so we'd be in the pool, you know, being bad and all that kind of stuff.
Nothing like a mother alerter, right?
Yeah. They would know probably anywhere between 8 and 10 minutes. They would start going crazy like clockwork.
They gave you a little leeway.
Oh, yeah. So we could, you know, do whatever we had to do and be good. But it was, you know, I missed the whole show, but I heard that guy call in, and I thought I had to call. And it was fascinating, but it was like clockwork, and the crow was never wrong.
And John, did you ever come up with a theory on how they knew how to do this?
I used to think they knew the sound of their engine in the car, but they would go crazy way too soon because we lived in a wooded area, and it was, you know, like I said, it was like 5 or 8 minutes. Which would probably be a couple miles.
I have a theory.
What's that?
A crow, 5 to 10 minutes ahead of the other crows, flew over and told them, she's on the way.
I never thought of
you
that.
Never know.
Anyway, well, that makes me think the Navy, they actually had a contract with the Duke Parapsychology Laboratory to figure out how pigeons home. They suspected that perhaps they were using ESP in some way.
Incredible guidance. And what did they deduce about pigeons? Did
they weren't able to.
Nothing.
Yeah.
Pigeons never talk.
Yeah.
Fort Worth, Texas, we go. Matthew, east of the Rockies. Hi.
Good evening.
Yes, sir.
I was wondering if he ever did research on hag attacks.
Now, that's you know what the hag syndrome is, Stacy, right?
No, I don't.
Okay. You know, people... when they go to sleep, they have sleep paralysis, which could be a medical condition, but others are just frozen in their beds, but they see this old grayish hag woman who kind of sits on their chest, crushes them, and they can't move. And they swear they see this hag.
What?
Probably a nice little old lady, but they swear they see this hag.
Does she want something from them?
Well, you know, myth says that when children see this hag, they grow up and become sickly, which is interesting. You know, she doesn't kill them or anything. She just, like, they get paralyzed, and this hag just is there. It's like she's from another dimension or something. I'm not sure JB ever research this.
This is the first I've ever heard of it.
You need to listen to this show a little bit more, Stacy.
Shame it did you. Not come up in the letters at all.
Okay. That's the Hag syndrome. Let's go to Bob in Las Vegas, Nevada, west of the Rockies. Hey, Bob, what's up?
Hey, thanks for taking my call, guys.
Sure
thing. Stacy, George, love to talk to you guys. I'm in a business closely, or at least I was, associated with yours. I was with NBC TV for 40 years.
Super.
And used to do a show for kids called Birthday House out of New York.
Oh, yeah.
Rockefeller Plaza.
Yeah.
And I was doing camera. And this was the early 60s, maybe mid-60s. I'm a skeptic by nature, but after gone through what I did, I believe. The night before I was to do this show, I had a dream that my camera fell off its stand, slid off. You know, in those days, you could slide them back and forth to adjust for teleprompters. You could adjust the wave.
Yeah.
And since we aimed down mostly for the little kids, I had to adjust the camera. And I had a dream that the camera fell off. And so the next morning when I showed up for the program, I told one of our maintenance guys, I said, stand by because I have a feeling I'm going to have a trouble with this camera. He says, okay, but I see nothing wrong with it. He checked it out. We went on the air.
Oh.
And then as soon as I panned down, or actually, I forget the terminology, panned left or right, and I forget, just aimed down, I guess, it started sliding. And went, while we're on the air taking pictures of the host of the show and the kid, the camera went off the stand, landed on the ground, scared the heck out of the host and the kid and everybody in the audience. And finally, other cameras took the shot.
And these were big cameras in those days.
Big RCA cameras.
Yeah.
Heavy, as you recall.
Huge. Huge.
On pedestals. And I, you know, scared. And I said to the maintenance guy, I'm glad you're here. And he said, it's a little too late. It's on the ground. But anyway, that was a dream come true. Not that I wanted it to happen. But it did come true. I had that premonition.
And let me ask you, Stacy, 20 seconds left. Did J.B. Ryan investigate dreams much?
Yeah. When I said they surveyed ghost stories, when they surveyed the letters, dreams was one of the things that they looked at to see what patterns emerged. And obviously one of the patterns that emerged was, you know, useful information was sometimes came in dreams.
The name of her work is called Unbelievable. Truly Unbelievable. For Karis Coburn, Dan Galante, Tom Danheiser, Lisa Lyon, Lex Lonehood, Sean Latasur, Ross Mitchell, George Nappy, and Punnett and Art Bell, I'm George Norrie. Somewhere out there on Coast to Coast AM, we'll see you on our next edition. Until then, be safe, everyone.